It is Sunday, September 22nd, 2013, and this is episode 36 of the Defensive Security Podcast. My name is Jerry Bell. I am here tonight with Mr. Andrew Kellett.
Good evening, everyone. Tonight, I'm joining you live and direct from an undisclosed location near a major military base.
And that's all we're allowed to say about it.
Mm-hmm.
Unless you follow Mr. Kellett on Twitter.
That's true.
And I think you'll know what's up.
That's a nice, kind of pimp for my Twitter account. I appreciate that.
It's a teaser, right?
It is.
At Lurg.
That's right.
Follow it. You'll know what's going on.
It's cool. That's
actually very cool, by the way. So I look forward to the outcome of that.
Yeah, I'm trying not to get my hopes up, but anyway, we're just teasing the audience. We'll talk about that later.
All right. So a little bit of housekeeping first. Next week, I am not entirely sure when the show is going to come out. I am intending to go to DerbyCon, and I'm meeting some people for lunch on Sunday, actually for dinner on Sunday. So it's a fairly long drive back, and we may not do the podcast till Monday or Tuesday, just depending on how schedules work out. So anyway, let's get on with the show. So there's a couple of interesting stories we have for you this week. The first one is a follow-up on something we talked about last week, and that was related to changing your Social Security number. So we said it was, I think we expressed some frustration about not being able to change your Social Security number, and one of our listeners pointed out that, in fact, there is a way to change your Social Security number, and I'll put that link in the show notes. The one thing I'd point out is, if you do change your Social Security number, you lose your credit history, or presumably you lose your credit history.
Yeah, it's not a panacea, because it's not like it cascades down to change your records at all of the various credit unions and other things. It's basically starting over. And it looks like there's a high bar you have to pass to get the Social Security Administration to issue you a new number. So it's not perfect, but it's much better than nothing. But what would be ideal is if you had a trusted federated system where I could say, some bad guys got my number, and now I want to change my number and change it with all the authorities and all the folks who are tracking it and using it and medical and everything else. But obviously that's a very difficult process, but that would be ideal.
And it was all linked together, and you could change it once everywhere. That would be pretty nice. I suspect at some point in the future we'll have to get there. I think identity theft is becoming so common that there's going to be a tipping point where the government's going to be forced to do something different.
Yeah, but the challenge there is that all of us libertarians will cry foul, and it'll come with a national gun registry, I'm sure. But it is a challenge. It's like I can see the upside, but I can see the downside of having one national database like that. But if you're forcing us to use a Social Security number, you might as well make it as secure as you can, and it's really on them to do it better.
Exactly. Well, anyway, enough about that. Following up on another story, and this is somewhat interesting. So related to the ever-present Edward Snowden leaks, there's some additional information coming out now about how the documents were stolen. And I find this really surprising and eye-opening about how the NSA apparently works. Allegedly, right? So there's a story, again, linked in the show notes, about how Edward Snowden, part of his job was to monitor this relatively open forum of documents. And in, I guess for lack of a better word, the NSA's intranet. And one of his job duties was to troll through the documents that were being talked about, looking for anything that was more sensitive than belonged to be there, and if he found something, to move it to the appropriate location. So it's kind of the perfect storm, right? He was not only charged with looking at all these documents and evaluating whether they belong there or not, but he was allowed and expected to move them from time to time.
You know, what I find really interesting about this story too is this file sharing location that he was monitoring was set up after 9/11 because the agencies weren't communicating well enough. So this is a perfect example of an enterprise having really hardcore information security policies and the users finding ways to go around them, or business not getting done, or something inhibiting some sort of productivity, and security gets thrown out of the window in, you know, in the pursuit of productivity. And this is a perfect example of that. I've seen countless times. And they threw this together, and I have no idea, because I wasn't there, of what sort of security, you know, mindset went into this. You know, obviously, we're dealing with an insider attack with, you know, high privileged information. That's a different problem. But I did find that this was a really interesting example of, if you make things too hard, if you make things too difficult, people will find a way to go around you if you're information security, and that is a nasty little problem to solve. The other thing I found interesting was, you know, as a sysadmin here, you know, at some point you kind of have to trust somebody, and they talk a little bit more. I don't want to steal your thunder about the rest of the article, but, you know, his job was to do this. So is this really a failure of background check? Is this a failure of, you know, proper monitoring of the proclivities of the people you do trust? It's an interesting problem.
Yeah, definitely. And this is a really tough problem. I think you were on a really good point about, you know, this being an example of what can happen when you kind of throw good security practices out the window. And I would also say that this is also highly likely to happen in the face of adversity, right? Adversity. Jeez. Wow. And I'm not even drinking, right?
Oh, that's, there's your problem. Bad.
So anyhow, as you pointed out, this was set up in the wake of September 11th. And so I've seen organizations do strange things in the wake of, you know, let's say a disaster or, you know, something like September 11th, you know, that can make an organization do things that they wouldn't normally do. And sometimes those things are done overtly, right? And I think In this particular case, I would bet it was done overtly, and somebody somewhere thought that they had covered their bases. You know, they said, okay, we'll set this thing up, right? But our checks and balances is to have some independent contractors trolling through what people are posting and talking about and looking for things that don't belong and moving them out. And, you know, not thinking about the entire context of, well, who's, you know, kind of the old mantra of who's watching the watchers.
Yeah, definitely. You know, this is one of those, we need to do something, right? This is a great example of, we just need to get something done. And in some ways, the risk was worthwhile, right? They felt that the communication improvements and the productivity improvements was worth the risk. And, you know, again, we're sort of extrapolating a bit here, but they got bit. Now, you know, what goes on to the rest of this is there's a brief mention in the story, too, where, you know, the way the NSA is going to fix this is introduce a quote-unquote two-man rule to remove anonymity from its network by ensuring no one with privileged access to its network is ever unsupervised. So how exactly is that going to work? Two sysadmins sit next to each other and watch everything each other does?
You know, since they announced the concept of the two-man rule, I've been trying to figure out how that's going to work. And the only thing I can come up with is that they're coming up with some customized workflow that in some way you know, requires the two keys to be turned at the same time, you know, the metaphorical equivalent of that.
That's what I was thinking about too. Two guys in the bunker getting ready to launch the missiles. You know, one thing I could see is maybe a checking out a one-time use password takes two people to authorize or something. I don't know. I'd love to know more about what exactly they're doing, because that's such a vague term, right? Two-man operation. Obviously, it's probably going to be incredibly inefficient and incredibly costly, most likely. But, you know, for certain situations, right, this is that careful balance of what kind of, how hardcore do you go to protect your assets, right?
Yes.
You always have to balance that cost versus the risk. And for these guys, there's almost no cost too high
right. In
their case. But that is not the case for most organizations, most enterprises. There is a cost too high. Right. So, you know, before we all start running out to our CIOs and board members and start proposing two-man system and operations, we may have to think about that for a minute. But yeah. It is interesting.
But I think there are some lessons to learn. Right. So if you are a very risk averse organization holding PHI, for example, you know, there's possibly some lessons to be learned here. And you know, one interesting thing I took away from this article, and I don't know if you picked up on it either, they're doing quite a number of things in response to this. They're implementing this nebulous two-man rule. They're going to start tagging their documents. And I assume that's going to enable some kind of data loss prevention schematic to work, right? So maybe it's...
Oh, you got to believe. You got to believe every DLP vendor on the planet started salivating after this. Which is, by the way, not a bad option here, right? This is exactly a DLP problem. However, once again, if you've got a full system in, you know, if you're root, you can get around a lot of this, right? So they've still got the problem of they've got a sysadmin, right? How do you deal with a sysadmin going rogue is almost a worst case scenario for an insider.
Yeah, definitely.
You know,
and apparently they're also, epoxying shut or ordering computers without USB drives.
Right, which is understandable, though they won't comment yet exactly on how he exfiltrated. You know, we can probably extrapolate that a USB drive was somehow involved.
Going back to the thing that I found most interesting is they're not changing this strategy. They're apparently not entertaining the idea of shutting down this, you know, thing that allows the NSA operators to comment and review and whatnot the documentation. They're just looking at how do they control the administrative aspect of this environment.
Well, isn't that kind of the point of proper InfoSec? It's not to say no, it's to say yes, but.
Yeah. But you know, the thing that is interesting to me is this story is all about administration, and I wonder what kind of controls they have around normal people whose job it is to consume this information.
Yeah. And you know, that may be something we never completely know, but I bet it would be a fascinating case study.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And how much of it is true trust and how much is technical controls, how much is, you know, straight up counterintelligence, you know, it would be interesting to know that.
Yeah. Well, I think, again, the lesson for a lot of organizations is if you have sensitive data, you know, it's not just the rank and file user that you have to worry about. It's also the administrator. And as you pointed out, you can take this to crazy extents, and you have to figure out what the right cost versus risk tolerance perspective your organization has. But I think this is highlighting that the threat's there.
Yeah, definitely.
All right, so moving on. This is another follow-up. Last week, I made a very passing reference to about a company being, for lack of a better word, dissed by their insurance company. And so I mentioned that I would go dig that story up. So the company in question is a grocery store named Schnucks. And Schnucks was compromised sometime between December of last year and I think March of this year And they had about 2.4 million credit card numbers and expiration dates stolen. So it's a fairly big deal. Now, they hired Mandiant to come out, and Mandiant identified that the attack was carried out using some malware that infected their environment and, you know, blah, 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 all kind of normal fare, right? But where it starts to go off the rails is that Schnucks has a policy, an insurance policy with Liberty Mutual. It's apparently a broad perspective property damage and loss policy that includes a cyber breach, and I think that's the actual name for it. So I'm not putting any money in the jar.
Noted.
but they have a cyber breach rider on their insurance policy. So the deal is that Liberty Mutual is suing Schnucks, and they're claiming that the policy they provide to Schnucks only covers costs related to responding to a breach. And so there isn't any definitive word on what that means, but I would mean it to, let's say, cover the cost that they had to pay to Mandiant, and maybe they have other internal fees related to the response and forensics, and possibly even they were able to claim some loss of sales or loss of business, as you would if your building burned down. And I would suspect that's somewhat normal fare. But right now, Liberty Mutual is suing Schnucks, saying they're not, Liberty Mutual is not liable to cover costs related to lawsuits that have been filed by Schnucks customers or any of the restitution that the banks and payment card processors are apparently going after Schnucks for.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting, and it does show the limits, right? So you can't transfer all the liability, clearly, at least with this particular policy. And I think that this is often going to be the case, where there's going to be riders, or there's going to be, you know, various sort of criteria around it. It's going to be really difficult to prove for them to pay out. So it will be very interesting to see how this plays out. I also find it interesting customers are suing them because of credit card breach. Last I checked, having my credit card number stolen is not my liability. So I'm not sure how the end customer is going to prove any damages when really all the damages are incurred by the card processor and the card agency.
I wonder the same. That's a very good point. And I don't know, other than to say, I think you can, at least here in the US, you can sue for just about anything. Whether you win or not, I guess it's a different question. So writing onto what you just mentioned, I think the point here for me, for me wanting to include this, is that cyber insurance is becoming a big thing. And, you know, as you know, a lot of the cyber war and the APT1 and you know, the advanced threat actors are coming on the scene, and malware is becoming really pervasive and on and on and on. I think a lot of companies are thinking about mitigating their risk, not only with security, but also with some component of insurance, which makes good sense. But you have to look closely at the limitations of what you're getting. And so I would postulate, I don't know for sure, right? But I would postulate that in the case of Schnucks, you know, the amount they lost from incident response cost is probably dwarfed by their liability from the banks and payment card processors.
Yeah, most assuredly. And I think this is just a new area, right, where we're constantly going to be sort of refining this. And I do think companies underestimate the liability involved in having a breach. And, the tough part is it's almost impossible to avoid a breach. So it's a real quandary. Yeah. And it may be just a level of shrinkage that companies are going to just have to figure out a way to deal with. And ultimately, we're all going to end up paying more for it. But, this is the kind of stuff that makes vendors of information security tools smile, because it's a great FUD marketing point to sell more security tools.
Right. But doesn't necessarily solve the problem. So moving on to the next story. So this is a little complicated. About 2 weeks ago, the British police announced that they had become aware of an attempted attack on a Santander Bank branch. And there's not a lot of detail about how it was found, but basically someone noticed that there was a KVM switch hooked up to a computer. And I'm using a little bit of liberty there because it's somewhat ambiguous. You know, there was a comment about the KVM switch being hooked up to the network. Well, you know, you don't hook KVM switches up to the network. You hook them up to a computer and you can remotely access them over the network. But anyway, so apparently nothing was done in that particular case. Then last week, British police again announced that they had arrested 12 people with stealing about £1.3 million stolen from Barclays Bank. And the way it was carried out was a network KVM switch was hooked up to a computer. Again, this is a little bit nebulous on details in the story, right? But apparently the KVM was hooked up to a computer, and on the other side, it was hooked up to a 3G router. And so it wasn't exiting through the bank's network. There wasn't anything for them to see. It was actually going out over the 3G network.
And which, by the way, pro tip, awesome technique that a lot of pen testers use.
Yes.
Small little micro guy plugged into 3G. Wonderful way to do things.
Pwn plugs. I don't
know if what'd you just call me?
Anyway, moving on. Google it. PWNPLUG. For anybody that's interested.
I'll have to turn safe search on before I do that, I think.
I would recommend it.
Yeah.
Don't do that on images. Yeah, you'll see some ugly stuff. All right. So what was interesting here was this was the perennial case that we all fear but never actually hear anything about it actually happening, where somebody walked in posing as a technician, socially engineered their way in and hooked up a piece of equipment to the back of a computer. And apparently for a couple of months, they were owning this computer. I would imagine they were doing it at night, but they had, they kind of had their way. And so we tend to get very wrapped up in what I'll call logical security. But this points out that, hey, there is an important physical aspect that we have to be aware of.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and these guys posed as IT technicians. Well, there's some nice social engineering right there.
Absolutely.
You know, and these are tiny little devices. And you're not going to sweep for 3G because everybody with a phone is going to trigger a 3G signal, right? Plus exactly. Other stuff hanging around. So this is a tough one, right? But you need to know what's being plugged into your boxes. If you've got physical access, game over.
Amen to that.
And it's not something to ignore. It's definitely something that can happen and fairly easily. And social engineering is trivial for most of these companies to easily get in and attach things. And this is at a branch office too. It's not like it's at the headquarters, right? So, you know, it's very easy for folks to come in and social engineer their way in and start touching stuff. And those guys out in the field aren't trained to know anything about IT security. And so this is a tough one. You know, and it may be something that folks need to think about a bit.
You know, if you listen to some of the other podcasts that cater more to the pen tester crowd, you'll hear constant stories about physical pen tests and how successful they are. People are just very trusting. If you present yourself well and you look like you belong there, you're probably going to get in.
Yeah, it's just human nature. And it's tough to train employees to be suspicious. It's not how we think and work as normal human beings. Right. We as security guys are, you know, warped and twisted and broken, and so we think otherwise. But I don't know. You know, what do you start doing? Putting your PCs in cages? Locking them down? I mean, but even at the end of the day, these guys are IT technicians, right? So if they said, unlock this cage, the worker would have did it. You know, and they attach some sort of IT-looking device that the average layman has no clue what it is or if it should be there or shouldn't be there.
Exactly.
So it's a tough one. It's definitely going after a nice weak spot at this organization.
Definitely. All right, moving on. The next story. There is yet another high-profile hacking group. And I would say that Symantec does not want to be outdone by Mandiant's APT1 report. So they released a report on a hacking group named Hidden Links, which apparently also operates out of China or out of that region of the world. It's a relatively long report. And, you know, I won't go through the report in painful detail because I think you probably ought to read it yourself. But I think the net, for me at least, is that we have, you know, more evidence of a very skilled hacking team with deep resources. And these, it's questionable whether their motives are related to the operations of a country or maybe they're for hire. You know, that's all speculative. We don't know. We may never know. But the point is, they have some very, very effective techniques. You know, one of the really interesting cases, and I've talked about this earlier in the year, they wanted to go after some military industrial companies. But apparently their normal mode of operations, using watering hole attacks to drop malware on computers of their intended victims, wasn't working because this company was using Bit9. So not to be perturbed by that, they went and hacked Bit9 and stole a signing certificate and started signing their malware with a Bit9 certificate, which allowed their malware to work on a PC protected by Bit9. So really, really, I would say determined attackers here with a lot of creativity. And this is the kind of adversary that I most dread, because they're not going to stop until they find a way in.
Yeah, it's nasty. You know, I'm actually a fan of Bit9, full disclosure, and I'm a fan of whitelisting apps. I think it's one of the few really effective ways to stop advanced malware. But, you know, this is such an excellent example of, again, what do you trust? You're putting your trust in whitelisting. You got to put your trust somewhere. And here that trust was exploited in a really effective, nasty way. And it's amazingly frustrating to have this sort of thing happen. And, you know, I'm not going to dissect all the stuff Bit9 did after, you know, I think they handled it fairly well and it definitely hurt their reputation. But at the end of the day, I still think that whitelisting is an effective tool. But here's an example of you just can't trust it, you know, as your sole line of defense. And, you know, then what do you do? At the end of the day, you know, while I have the soapbox for a moment, I will say that I don't know that there's anything you can do to 100% keep everybody out. I just don't think you can. So then you have to shift your mindset to do everything you can, make it hard, but try to put enough instrumentation and technology around that when somebody does get in, A, you're going to know some way, somehow. B, you can contain it quickly, you know, with the assumption that, hey, they're going to get in. So how can I architect around finding out about it? And that means, you know, not, you can't trust the box once that box has been popped. So that's probably some sort of network-based, tap-based, inline-based detection of some variety. And there's a lot of different ways to get into that. I don't want to kill a bunch of time. We could talk about it on another show. But so you can detect with the, yep, you know, if you go in with the assumption that they're going to get in.
But basically plan for failure, right?
Yeah, which, you know, is a depressing thing. And it's frustrating, by the way, to say that to executives. They don't like that answer. They want solutions. They don't want, what do you mean you can't keep them out, right? So it's sometimes can be a tough sell, but I think it's the real world we're living in right now of, you know, when you look at really determined adversaries like this, and of course, not every adversary out there is at this level and at this level of sophistication, this level of patience, this level of organization. But they do exist. And it was funny because I've been in the IT world a long time, information security world a long time. And we used to talk about this happening without it actually happening, you know, as a marketing technique. But now it's really happening. And it's kind of getting to the point where we as defenders are so far behind the curve that we really almost have to change our paradigm. and I'm not trying to use buzzwords here, but this sort of just blocking at the edge, and you know, it's just not working. It's just not working. And this is a great example of that. And, you know, these guys tried to do the right thing, right? They had Bit9, which is a great tool, and they did a bunch of other stuff. And still, these guys went and attacked Bit9. Now, shame on Bit9 for not, protecting their environment better, and I'm sure that that will never happen to them again. But, you know, we saw the same thing happen to RSA. And I think we're going to continue to see this, where if they want to get in, they're going to go after these sort of security vendors, knowing that I've got to blind and deafen this tool to get to what I want. So it's a tough one.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're right on. And I agree. I've become thoroughly convinced that the whitelisting approach is really, I would say, probably the way of the future. I think it's hard to call traditional AV completely dead, but you know, the reality is it's just becoming a much different world, and we have to look at it through the lens of whitelisting and not blacklisting anymore. And I do think that it was an unfortunate incident with Bit9, but I don't think that necessarily splashes badly on the concept. And I think anybody could have fallen into the trap that Bit9 fell into.
Absolutely. And you know, not trying to give Bit9 a pass in any way here, but now it becomes, how do they react going forward?
Yes.
Right? Did they learn their lesson, as it were, right? And they are much more, let's just say, paranoid internally, you know, the cobbler's children having no shoes sort of situation. We'll see, right? This could have been a good sort of wake-up call to them that they have some very valuable IP they need to protect, and their entire reputation, entire business model is based on protecting those certs at the end of the day.
Yep.
And you know, hopefully they learn that lesson, and I hope other IT security vendors realize this as well. But I think it's going to be like organizations; they'll spend the money to protect themselves properly once they've had a breach.
Absolutely.
And that's, you know, the other thing I found interesting about this is you know, this is put up by Symantec. A, they didn't get nearly the press of Mandiant. Sorry, Symantec. B, they read a 28-page document, and the only thing they have for advice is use multiple tools. Thank you, Symantec.
Which, as I was mentioning in the pre-show, is essentially what they said to the media outlet that was hacked as part of one of the APT1 attacks, either late last year or early this year. I don't remember if it was the New York Times or the Washington Post, but it was one of them. And at the time, the media outlet said, hey, Symantec's antivirus didn't protect us. And then Symantec's response was, well, you weren't using all of the right tools from our portfolio. So, that seems to be somewhat typical of their marketing. And, you know, going back to Bit9 for a second, I did talk about them, and my recollection was that this was a server that was stood up on their network. And, you know, this is a really major problem, and it's one of those fundamental things that organizations need to get a handle on. You've got to have really effective change control. So one of the best ways to avoid some of these attacks, or at least make it harder, is to do the fundamentals. Know what's on your network. Keep things off of your network that don't belong there. If it's on your network, it needs to be properly managed. And that was the case here. Apparently, I think it was a virtual machine got spun up and it wasn't properly patched and it wasn't actually running their security agent. And so
it was, I think there were three boxes not running Bit9 that got popped.
Yeah. Yep. So fundamentals are important, people. So there was one other thing that I thought was really interesting, and they didn't do a lot of explanation of this. And apparently there was a case that this hacking group apparently replaced a driver that was distributed with some, you know, quote, military grade computers to the defense industrial sector. Don't know if that was the military itself or contractors, But they replaced a driver with one that was infected with a Trojan. So your computer came pre-infected.
Yeah, that's nasty, right? And that's the kind of stuff we've always worried about. Counterfeits coming out of China with, you know, pre-infections in the hardware. Lots of stuff. Again, it goes back to, what do you trust? Yes. It seems like I'm harping on that this show, but it's interesting. You know, we could spend a whole show just talking about the techniques in here, and I would encourage everyone to read it. They do a really good job of sort of explaining the techniques and the methodology that Hidden Links uses. And I wonder if we're going to start getting, you know, hidden insert cat name here next to be Hidden Mountain Lion, Hidden Cougar. Wait, that's at the bar. Sorry, go on.
You know, I actually interpreted it to be the web browser.
Yeah, that's right.
But you know, I don't know. You might be right.
Next, it'll be Hidden Gopher. Yes, I just dated myself.
Ooh. Ouch.
Wow, I know. I'm old.
or Hidden Finger.
Oh, hey now, hey. Hey. Hidden UUnet. I don't know.
All right.
We've spun that badly out of control. Is it time for Attack of the Week? Week.
It is. All right. It is. I proudly came up with, for this week, password attacks. And this one is personally interesting to me because it comes up quite a lot. And there's a lot of organizations that are struggling with password policies and what's the right approach, what's the right way to think about passwords. We've additionally seen, I don't know how many breaches of public sites and you know, password hashes being dumped and all sorts of new techniques to brute force hashes. And so now there's gigantic dictionaries and there's people doing analytics on how common different passwords are and on and on and on. So I wanted to talk a little bit about this. You know, it's a huge area, right?
There's so much that goes into passwords and protecting passwords and hashes and salting the hashes and, you know, peppering the hashes. I don't even know. There's so many things.
But there's a couple of things that I think are foundational to make sure we all understand and ways to think about it. So when I think about passwords and protecting passwords, there's really two different contexts that in my mind I think about passwords. I think about them in a white box model and a black box model. And in a white box model, you can, for instance, see how the passwords are stored. And so this is the case of, let's say, websites who are vulnerable to SQLi or, you know, some other system where you can obtain the hash. And in those particular cases, the thing that's really important is how you hash it. It's really a combination of how strong the password is and how well you hash it. So it's almost impossible to pick a password strong enough for, you know, a vanilla MD5 non-hashed password to be strong enough. You know, it's such an expedient algorithm. It was built for speed. And now with GPU clusters and whatnot, it's ridiculously easy. And, you know, you can salt it. That helps some, but still, unless you're doing lots and lots of iterations, it's still very trivial to brute force. So when you think about things in the context of a white box model where, you know, let's say the hash can be sniffed from the network, it's susceptible to being taken out of a database table, you know, you really now have to think about how you're storing those hashes. You're going to want to use something that is computationally very expensive, like a PBDCAF2 or, you know, one of those with lots of rounds of iterations where, you know, it might take a very long time with current computing technology to, you know, attack a hash with a password of any length. Now, interestingly, there's been a recent attack on some sites who have moved to PBDKF2. I don't remember the acronym off the top of my head, but there's been some attacks where people are feeding in long passwords and denial of servicing the server because that algorithm is so computationally expensive that if you, let's say, feed it a 1 megabyte password, which, by the way, is probably not the best thing to accept in your input field, but you can denial of service a server. So you have to think about kind of the end-to-end implications of what you're implementing. And again, plan for failure. You know, if you're hosting a web app, think about what you're going to do when that password file or password list gets stolen. And, you know, don't think that just because, you know, you had a pen test that you're all safe, right? You need to think about this.
So I hear you saying, assume your hash file is going to get swiped.
Yes.
What about going to something like, you know, what do you think about complex password routines or having to change every month?
Ah, so now here's where it starts to get a little interesting. This is where I think a lot of the meat of consternation for a lot of organizations is, you know, what's the right level of complexity to have for my password? How often should I have people changing their password? And there's not a good answer for that. There was a really great podcast, and I think it was on Paul.com a couple of months ago, and they were interviewing one of the guys that worked at Bell Labs a long, long time ago, and they were talking about the genesis of the 8-character password and how it was really related to the ability to brute force, an 8-character password within a certain period of time. And so it's interesting to me that we continue, for the most part, to still use that as our de facto standard. To me, 8 characters is just simply ineffective in any context, especially a business context. And, you know, I've become a very large proponent of letting a machine generate the password for you because, you know, let's say you have a very long password. People are terrible at picking a random password.
Okay, so I've got a computer-generated 10-digit password, and I've got full disk encryption, and the first thing I hit on starting my computer is I've got to enter that 10-digit randomized password, and I've got no password manager and no good way to memorize it, so I just wrote it down.
You know, there are
not to play devil's advocate here, but I'm going to play devil's advocate.
It's an interesting point. So Bruce Schneier actually talked about this recently, and I think his point was it would be better for you to write it down than to use a weak password.
And that is a very interesting, compelling point. You know, for me, at a personal level, I use a password manager, and I use a randomized auto-generated password for each of my sites, which, by the way, when you actually go to doing that for the first couple of weeks while you're shifting over to that, can be a massive pain in the butt, but afterwards it's a wonderful thing. As long as, again, that cloud-based password manager doesn't get popped, right? Then you're screwed. You know, it's like where you got to trust something. But it's a tough problem. And so my organization, for instance, I have to shift my password, every 45 to 60 days. And so believe it or not, I have a formula. And I think this is what most people do, where they rotate the password so it's different enough, but still the same enough. And you know, I don't think it's effectively helping anything. I don't really think a password change routine is helpful. I really don't. I think an inactive account disablement is probably helpful.
Yes.
But, you know, the concept is if someone's popped your password, you know, they've only got it for a certain period of time, et cetera. But you know, I don't know. I mean, what do you think about two-factor, whether it be, you know, something like a token code as like an RSA token or safe word or, you know, a certificate plus a password? How do you feel about those?
So I am a big fan of two-factor. I am a big detractor of biometric two-factor. I think it's a just a horrible, terrible blight upon society.
Apple disagrees with you.
Well, I know. My wife just got an iPhone 5, and you know, we're training it to recognize the cat's paws.
Breaking news. Yes, indeed. Steve Jobs' body has risen from the ground. He's coming for you, Jerry. As we speak.
But in general, I am a big fan.
And by the way, if you can get the cat's paws to work, you have to make a video of that and post that.
I will.
That would be epic.
I will. I'll do it. I'm going to do it.
Because you are following the Is iTouch Hacked Yet thing, I'm sure.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And,
you know, breaking news as of today. The Chaos Computer Club out of Germany says they have a working hack.
Yeah, there was a pretty big bounty for it, wasn't there?
Yes, although there's tons of drama around that too. So somebody, you know, completely off topic, but somebody threw in 10 grand and now has been, you know, media whoring over it. I'm quoting. And has now backed out. Well, we don't know for certain, but appears to have backed out of ponying up that 10 grand into escrow. And I'm purposely not saying who, because I don't want to give them any more attention. With our vast thousands and thousands upon millions of listeners, however, I'm sure if you wanted to, you could find it on Twitter pretty quickly. And there's news reports coming out on it now. But all that being said, the Chaos Computer Club appears to have found a way, at least in one video. So we're on a maybe unconfirmed yet of once you get a password. You can scan it. Sorry, not a password, a fingerprint. If you scan it at a high resolution, print it on a basically clear plexiglass thing, then do some stuff with, like, you know, some physical materials like milk or something else that they did to actually give it some depth, it apparently can spoof it. So I know I'm butchering explaining this because I just read it like an hour ago briefly, but it is interesting that they are looking at this. But, you know, sorry to go off on a rant, but I 100%, 110% hate. Have I said hate? Hate flames on the side of my face. Hate using biometrics because you can never change your fingerprint.
That's right.
And once somebody can spoof it, you're toast forever.
You can't change it. And by the way, especially fingerprints, you leave everywhere. It blows my mind.
Now I can already hear people typing. You can change your fingerprints with plastic surgery. All right, yes. Let's say for all practical purposes, 99% of us cannot change our fingerprints.
I'll tell you, I'm not changing my fingerprints. You know, I'll go find a different job. I'm sorry.
And, you know, you do leave it everywhere. It's like walking around saying your password all day. ABC123, ABC123, ABC123. Which, by the way, I think is a beautiful password. I use it all the time.
Yeah, and, good.
You know, it's much like having an open Wi-Fi. So if anything happens with my accounts, I can just say, I don't know, it was open. Somebody else did it.
That's right. You can't break in if it's, you know, if it's wide open.
I know. We've gone dangerously off topic here. Anyway, so you don't like
biometrics.
Yes, I agree with you. Biometrics are evil, but they're convenient, right? The thing about biometrics is they're convenient. But I think it's a false sense of trust and a false sense of security. And but I feel like that train has left the station and we're never going to stop it.
I agree. You know, I do find it particularly interesting that we now have a major piece of consumer electronics with, you know, a prominently featured biometric two-factor. Actually, it's not really two-factor. It's just one factor, which is your fingerprint. But, you know, the concept is interesting now that it's kind of out there in mainstream. And I wonder, you know, potentially how it might be used in the future. Right. So you could see that being used and adopted in, you know, more mainstream things like banking applications and possibly actually used in real two-factor scenarios. So, we'll have to see what happens there. But, you know, I do think that the more traditional two-factor is a very good thing. It's not perfect. You know, it's just not. There's nothing that's perfect, but it's a heck of a lot better than anything else, or for the most part, that's out there. And even certificates, I'm a relatively big detractor of certificates because, you know, it's not unlike a password. It can be relatively easily stolen. Now, I do know that there are some of the, let's say, smart cards where it's more of a challenge type system where it's not necessarily a certificate per se. And that is probably better, but I don't see that a lot. I see the certificates much more commonly.
Yeah, I would agree. And, you know, the upside of certificates, though, is typically the certificates, unless they've gone after your certificate store, you know, they're sitting on an endpoint. So, you know, if you've got bad guys coming from China and they're just trying to pop passwords, it's a pretty healthy defense against that because they're not going to have both the password and the cert very easily. And I think that would, you know, be somewhat of a deterrent, I think.
Yeah, I think so. I just,
you know,
I have a philosophical problem with both of your factors being in the same band, you know, right? So
yep.
You know,
that brings up another interesting one too, which is we're seeing some of the stuff like being able to SMS back token codes and stuff to you.
Absolutely.
And, you know, first of all, how do you feel? I feel like I'm interviewing you, but first of all, what do you think about that? And second of all, do you think it's ready for mainstream that a non-technical executive would put up with it?
I think it is ready for mainstream, and I know that from using Facebook and Google and others, that it's relatively unobtrusive and fairly straightforward to use. I'm not a big fan of it from the perspective of, you know, I'm on my cell phone, I log into my Facebook account, and I get prompted to enter my token code, which promptly gets delivered to my phone. Now, you know, it's a trivial case with Facebook. You know, I know there's some downside to people owning your Facebook account for sure. But, you know, let's say that's a banking account. And we know that there are, especially on the Android platform, there are pieces of malware. I think Gitmo was one, or Spitmo, sorry, where it would intercept those two-factor tokens coming in via SMS.
No, Gitmo is where they're going to send us. We're talking about Snowden.
That's right. That's right. I get that confused.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's, this is the problem, right? We're letting perfect be the enemy of good enough. We're just about anything we can think of, we can find a way to counter, and we can find a way to fight it, and we can find a way to exploit it. And at some point, you've got to, you know, do something, right? but you got to find that right balance, obviously.
It is better than static passwords. There is no question about it. Unquestionably, using a two-factor code coming in via SMS, even on the same phone, is better than just the static password. I'm not going to stand up and say that.
So what would be your sort of recommendation as a holistic summarization of password security and resisting a password attack?
Number one, lock out accounts after a certain number of failed attempts and follow up on them when they happen. Or at the very least, do something to rate limit how fast people can guess, right? So going back to my initial topic or description of this, you know, that's kind of the black box view where you don't know the hash, so you have to actually brute force the application. You know, in that particular case, you can get away with a relatively weak password and not get owned, but it's very important, I think, in almost every context, at least in every reasonable context, to do something to rate limit how often people can try password guessing. On my server, and I've talked about this in the past, and I'm probably giving up too much, but, you know, I have a script that looks for failed login attempts, and, you know, you get a certain number of tries, and then you're gone. You're just firewalled off. And, you know, I've got a lot of firewall rules from people all over the internet trying to break in. And that is...
But Jerry, I can already hear them say, couldn't you spoof it and use that as a DOS?
No, because they're TCP.
All right, but then that's a timing attack, right? So if I know that you've got a critical server on a critical IP, and I just time the forged TCP package properly to convince your host, there are tools out there that do that.
That's a whole lot harder than just...
All right, fair enough.
Just you know, getting on a booter site and paying someone to denial of service your server. That's
right. Fair point.
You know, there's easier ways.
Can you tell a little feisty tonight? I don't know why.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, it's that proximity to the military base, I think.
Could be.
It's got you going. So that's one. I would say don't let people generally pick their passwords, right? Now, you brought up a really good point about the initial login password. And let's say your TrueCrypt or your PGP whole desk encryption password. You know, you can make a case that says, you know what? Let somebody pick something that's memorable to them and, you know, let them get the system up and running. I do know that, for instance, in the case of PGP, most organizations have it set up so that it uses your Windows login password. So you don't have to remember a different password. But, you know, if you require some ungodly complex thing. Now, I'll tell you what I personally do. I use LastPass? I think it's LastPass. Anyway, you know, it's pretty well encrypted. And I have a really long password that is memorable to me. And I store
that up to all the girls.
I know, I do. Yeah. And I store that up on a Dropbox, so I can get to it on my iPad, my
and
iPhone,
now,
whatever.
And now that everybody knows this, you will be hacksword by the end of the day.
Well, probably so. But it's inside a TrueCrypt vault, so you have to do a lot, right? I didn't make it easy. Not impossible, but I didn't make it easy. But anyway, point is, I can get to my passwords from you know, not just my computer, but from my phone and whatnot. So I would say don't let people pick their own passwords for the most part. You know, use some kind of auto-generated password utility. You know, one thing that I would really like to see websites do in the absence of two-factor is start giving people the password. Don't necessarily let them set it on their own. I think that's just a bad idea, and it's what contributes to the big problem of, you know, the same password being used on many, many, many sites. And I know that it's, you know, you should be allowed to do whatever the heck you want, but I'm just saying, for the good of society, people aren't doing it, and it's a simple change.
But if you wrap this back into a corporate environment, you know, the problem is that we've now gone to a, you know, a single sign-on, single password environment for ease of use across, and, you know, access control and everything else across the organization. So it's really, really difficult to have different passwords in a corporate enterprise environment.
Well, that's very true. That's a very good point. And I think it goes back to the importance of locking out accounts and doing some kind of follow-up to find out what's going on. I know too many organizations don't really pay attention to that. And, you know, and then they wonder, well, you know, boy, how did we get hacked? Well, if you had been paying attention, you would have seen people, you know, brute forcing, you know, for a long time. And you had an opportunity to recognize it and respond. So single sign-on does add an interesting dimension. It does also say, hey, two-factor is another opportunity to mitigate some of the risk there. So, you know, there isn't a silver bullet here, as with most of security. But, you know, I really think that we have to think this through. I'm very annoyed at a lot of the very, I don't know how to put this right, but the very basic but blindly followed password guidance that organizations have had, you know. So, you know, we're going to be 8 characters with one number and one uppercase and one special character required, and you have to change your password every 90 days, period, end of sentence. We don't want to talk about, you know, anything different. And I think that's really wrong-headed. you know, especially in different contexts. You know, one of the, when you look at some of the attacks that have happened recently, a lot of the recent attacks actually primarily are against Windows shops, right? And so the pass the hash types of attacks are very effective. And when you've got an 8-character password where people are, you know, not generating a high entropy password, it's not going to take long for most of those get brute forced by an attacker.
Yeah. And, you know, there's a part of me that would say, how often is that the prevalent type of attack? And, you know, that kind of thing. But, you know, again, we could do a whole show on this one thing. And it's an interesting topic.
You know, I would be interested in hearing from anybody out there that has any, you know, any unique views or anything interesting that they do. I know that different organizations, in some cases even different countries, have some unique view on identity management. But, you know, there's lots of different avenues. Oh, you know, one other one, you mentioned it, and this is a great one. Expire your accounts. If an account isn't used, expire it. Just don't let it log in.
And audit your damn accounts.
Yeah, critically, you know, important.
And this is where it kind of goes back to, it's a weakness and a strength to have a truly unified password environment across all of your servers, because it's a lot easier to manage your accounts. And so that's a risk you take. But at the same time, I think the advantage probably outweighs the risk in most organizations and individually managed, therefore badly managed, password policies on individual servers and environments.
Yep, definitely. Well, I, as you said, we can go on with this one for hours and hours. I'd be interested to hear from the listeners if you have any unique perspectives on this. Any ideas to share with other listeners, you know, send it in, info@defensivesecurity.org. And I think we're going to end it. This is definitely going to be the longest show yet.
Well, hopefully it's valuable. Hopefully people are still listening, you know, at this point. But hey, if you like the show, let us know. If you don't like the show, let us know. If you hate us, let us know. Follow us on Twitter and send us email, and we hope you find this valuable.
Yeah, and as a reminder, the Twitter ID is @DefensiveSec. The email is info@DefensiveSecurity.org. My Twitter handle is @MaliciousLink. Mr. Kalitz is @Lurg. And the website is www.DefensiveSecurity.org. If you do happen to like this podcast, I would ask you, please go onto iTunes and give us a 5-star rating, or hey, even a 4-star rating. Whatever you think we deserve. It helps us creep up the ratings. I think we're down below some elementary school that once talked about security. So that would be very helpful to us. And by the way, I do apologize. There is an intermittent echo in the podcast when I'm talking. You know, that's one of those things that happens when you're doing a podcast, and we roll with it. So I appreciate everyone's time, and I hope this was useful to you, and we will talk to you again next week. Again, it'll be Monday or Tuesday, and say good night.
Good night, Gracie.
All right. Take care.